Thank you so much. Thanks for the invitation to this great conference. This has been a lot of fun, and it's nice to be here at PI again. All right, so everybody's tired at this point, so I will try to, well, not to overburden you too much with mathematics, but I'm a mathematician, so please excuse me for a bit of technicalities. Okay, so let me start with a short recap of what has already appeared in some of the talks. I'm looking at Giovanni and Michele. So BVBFV, it's in the title, so I should explain what that is. So this is actually nothing else here but a sort of bookkeeping mechanism for where do I assign various variables and where do I assign symmetries and, you know, where do various animals live in my zoo. So let's start with some manifold M, and to that manifold I want to assign the following data. So there is going to be a graded symplectic manifold. This is going to be something that describes both my symmetries and equations of motion. There's going to be the action functional. I'm a very Lagrangian person. I always work with action functionals. I like action. And then there's going to be an odd vector field that well, has information about all the cool stuff, so tells me what are the symmetries, what are the equations of motion, and, well, that's it for now. And then BFV is when I also consider stuff on the boundary, so my manifold has a boundary, and then I also associate some stuff to it. And here is a funny game, so there is some grading there which essentially allows me to keep track of where things belong, and this grading is going to be different when I go higher codimension. So here I had something -1, here I have something 0 shifted, and if I continue to the corner, then I will have +1 shifted and so on. So again, we have some data here which is of the same type, more or less, just different grading. And with the difference that this symplectic form is actually exact. So that's the BFV data. And there is, again, boundary action. So boundary action is going to be an important guy in this story. So this is something which I'm going to use later. And again, there is an odd vector field that describes, again, all the data of the theory assigned to the boundary. Okay, now, is this the end? Well, it depends. So this is a corner conference, so there has to be a corner. Let's see. First of all, let's see if we can, come up with some consistency condition for this data, right? We have something in the bulk, something on the boundary. There is some, relations between these data. So this tells us how the variation of the action is obtained in terms of the symplectic form and the differential. And here is a little correction to that, which is coming from the fact that you have boundary. So this kind of equation links information from the bulk and information from the boundary. So that's the first step. There is this sort of double insertion, which if we didn't have the boundary, this double insertion would give us 0, but here it doesn't. This is something like a master equation later on, and this gives us the pullback of the boundary action. Okay, and so on. So this is now a similar relation as the one before, but for the boundary action, so giving the variation of the boundary action in terms of symplectic form and the differential, and then there is this double insertion. Okay, now this is the situation where we don't have corners. Now if we introduce corners, well, then these two identities are going to again be broken by something which comes from the corner. So with the corner situation, then we modify the third one with adding a piece from the corner, and we modified the fourth one by adding a piece from the cone. So, and then in principle, you know, if we were in higher dimensions, we can continue going on and on and have some higher situation. And this is going to be the example I want to illustrate in QED, okay? So this was just the basics to connect with the other talks, but now I want to spend the rest of the time working through an example where you can see how these things come up and why they are useful. Okay, so first of all, I want to consider asymptotic boundary because, I'm interested in asymptotic QED. So there is an obvious generalization of that story when we take the boundary to infinity. So we impose some fall-off conditions on our fields so that something survives on the boundary, and then we go far out. Okay, so this is based on the joint work with Michele, and now you might ask yourself, or me actually, or Michele, why have we done that? So, I think I mentioned I'm a mathematician, so there is an obvious motivation for me. I want to put everything in my favorite language, so that's item one. And be able to sort through various, you know, symmetries, observables, and stuff. As I said, describing my favorite language, which is, in this case, homological algebra. Now, another fun exercise was to show that the conservation of asymptotic charges is actually related to the condition of vanishing of the boundary action. So there is a sort of link between something you expect on mathematical grounds and something that you expect on physical grounds. So that was another thing we did. There is also quantization. That is actually what I do for a living, quantizing things. This story is totally classical, but this is the first step for being able to quantize it. There were also some controversies in the literature which we wanted to resolve. So we took all that machinery and applied it to an example that, we think we understand, okay? Because quantum gravity is maybe a bit hard, but QED, we have it for a long time. It's well tested experimentally, so that should kind of work. Okay, so talking about controversy, I want to maybe draw your attention to some literature that may or may not be known. I think for most people it is not known. I did my first degree in Krakow, in Poland, working with Andrzej Herdegen, who happened to be interested in asymptotic algebra of QED since the 90s. So this is where I learned that stuff. He did an awful lot of things, and some of these, I think, can shed a new light on the results that everybody is now interested in. So this is the first paper if you want to, dig into the prehistory of the subject. This is maybe a place to start. So he was interested, he's still interested in understanding QED as such, but asymptotic structure plays there a role. The first paper was more of a classical story. The second paper is quantization, a kind of canonical quantization. You see, there is a bit of a break, right? So 90s. And then more recently, there was a lot of interest in these things coming essentially from these works, New Symmetries of Masses QED and New Symmetries of QED by Strominger et al. There is some overlap between these works, but more importantly, there are some interesting differences that I would like to comment on. And Herdegen also commented on those. So after Strominger's papers, he wrote a paper where he kind of made a comparison between his work and the newer works, he expressed his opinion about large gauge symmetries. Okay, this, I think, wasn't an entirely satisfactory response because there were still some discrepancies between the two descriptions, and this is where my paper with Michele comes in. So with that short bibliographical note, let me just say what is it all about and why there were controversies. Okay, so what Hardegen said in his paper, and you can look it up and see his argument in detail, that there is no new gauge symmetry of QED, okay, because he took some issue with large gauge transformations. So he says, well, you know, large gauge transformations are not real honest to goodness symmetries of the asymptotic structure. So on this ground, for example, one should not think of them as new symmetries of the theory. This sounds a bit pedantic, but he has a bit of a point there. But we derive those things using Noether procedure, right? We get conservation laws, so what is wrong? What actually is the big deal? Why aren't they honest-to-goodness symmetries? So, this is where we applied our machinery. So, you can take issues with BVBFV framework as well, but at least it has a sort of nice way of sorting various concepts. So it tells you, you give me a transformation, I will tell you if it's a symmetry or not, or you give me a quantity and I will tell you if it's an observable or not, because this is all kind of encoded in this data I showed you in the beginning. So this actually provides an ambiguous mathematical answer to the question of interpretation. Are these large gauge transformation symmetries or not? And if they are, in what sense? Okay, so that's going to be the focus of the talk. And you have already seen that picture before, but I will draw it here for reference. This is my favorite Minkowski spacetime, right? Compactified with scry. I never know how to draw scry. Scry minus, scry plus, the space like infinity, time like past infinity, and the future infinity. Okay, so we want to keep that for later. And on this picture, I want to introduce some notation, okay? So we are looking at QED, but I'm not able to keep track of the signs if there are too many. So, the photon is okay, it's a boson, I like bosons, for matter fields, I'm going to consider scalar QED because I don't want to be bothered with fermions, at least in this talk. So, fall of conditions, right? Photons are going to fall like 1 over r. R is the sort of length parameter distance from the origin, more or less. And they are propagating along null directions, so like that. And matter fields, their asymptotes live at future and past infinity, so they go from very long time ago to very far in the future. Okay, now this is where we want to be, but before we get there, we need some setup which deals with finite boundaries so that we can take all the limits and everything. So here is a sort of, mini diamond with corners cut off, so maybe that's similar to what Sabrina was talking about. So this is a finite region of Minkowski depending on the parameter r that will blow up that region to infinity, and it consists of four pieces. So there are these null pieces that come from breaking apart two light cones or one double cone, and there are these pieces here, the cups that come from mass hyperboloids. And here for the parametrization, well, on these guys, I will use the hyperbolic time here to characterize how far away are they, how close to infinity. And for these guys, I will use some parameter r, which corresponds to like the radius, space-like radius. Okay, so that's the box we are defining things initially. Yes? Cube.
Today is not working anymore. Do you want another one?
Sorry, can you just say why you need the you need the caps as opposed to, is there something wrong with the letting the null generators hit each other or something? Or?
So I want to have room for my matter fields to live in. So I'm going to consider asymptotics of both matter and photons at the same time. So I want them to be able to play together and both go to infinity.
You want somewhere for the massive.
Sorry?
The massive part.
The massive part, okay. Yeah. So the massive guys are going to live here. And so this is a good model because this stuff goes to future infinity and this corner here, goes to the corner at scry, right? So that would end up here. I don't have enough dimensions.
Kasia, you have another question?
Yes.
Yeah, so maybe I should have asked this sooner, but when you were writing down the BFV
yes.
formalism, and when you add corners, do you not also get corrections to the first two equations that you've written down?
Do I get corrections?
Yeah, from the corners of the first two equations that you've written down.
So it's sort of goes in this hierarchy, right? So you have the corner corrects the boundary corrects the bulk. But if there is some generalization with corners, then maybe you guys know that better. I mean, not in this case, but in general.
Okay.
Cube? I think yes, but not in this case, right?
Exactly, yes, but not in this case. You can always consider it. But
yeah, not for QD, but you guys might have some nice examples where that actually plays a role. I will carry on then. And this is how I parameterize the fields, and I'm going to do it a bit unorthodox because I want to play homage to my mentor, Andrzej Herdegen. So I'm going to use his variables. And as a bonus, you know, you might be able maybe to understand his notation after this talk. So that's not a waste of time then. Okay, so here is how he does it. And I think it's clever because it's geometrical and I really like geometry. So he says, well, okay, so first of all, what we are interested on scry are null directions. So null directions live on the light cone. And then what else do we need to describe the position on scry? Well, we can choose a time-like plane intersected with the null cone. And then this parameter t, well, this sort of parameter that characterizes on which plane are we, okay? In that, this is going to be some parameter s. So here in this parameterization, any point of spacetime would be given by a null direction multiplied by r, and then there is some fixed time-like direction that gives me that hyperplane, and then parameter s that would kind of characterize like where that hyperplane sits. Okay, and then that gives me a very nice way of describing null asymptotics, so I'm just taking r to infinity, so going far away on null directions. So the variables here are going to be r, l, and t, and l is the one on the light cone. Okay, so now for BV again. So here is the data. This is now concrete examples of what I was talking about abstractly. So this is the shifted symplectic structure. Let me explain what these guys mean. So A is, of course, the vector potential. Now, this guy with the daggers, this is a sort of like a dual, like a source variable called an antifield. So each variable has its dual friend. This essentially is it, right? So we have vector potentials, we have ghosts that characterize the BRST symmetry, and then we have matter fields, so phi and phi bar. Okay, and the action. So this is the just electromagnetic part, and here there is the matter Lagrangian, and we have the coupling between the matter and the electromagnetic field through the covariant derivative that acts on phi. You can see this as the usual thing from physics textbooks. Okay, and this is now Q. So Q, as I said, has all the information about equations of motion and symmetry. So let's see if I'm not cheating. So Q acting on those dual variables gives me equations of motion. Okay, so equating that to zero. So in other words, you know, in cohomology, I would quotient by the image of Q. So it means I would equate those things to zero. That would correspond to going on shell, so implementing equations of motion. And again, these are equations of motion you might recognize. Okay, and this bit here is gauge symmetries, right? So there is a gauge symmetry acting on A, on the matter fields. And here, that would be the commutator, but we are in abelian theory, so the commutator is zero. So, yes.
For people who are not familiar with this,
for
thing,
sure.
The one for phi, the new phi, depends on, it's not really the equation of motion because there's the C phi on the right? So this guy would be zero. Yes.
So it's in degree zero. Yes, correct. So the equation of motion bit would be the degree zero.
And then how do you fix this extra
decoration? So we found these, yeah.
And how do you fix these ones?
Oh, yeah. So the equations of motion would be the cohomology of that in degree zero. That part here wouldn't contribute because that is not, that's a good point, a bit technical. So you want to split this differential according to degrees. So this part here would be in degree higher. So the equations of motion would be computed from the lowest degree. So because anti-fields, so the dual guys are in degree one, and the honest to goodness fields are in degree zero. So okay.
And can you remind the compatibility condition is that IQ of omega is delta S? The compatibility between Q, IQ of omega is delta S, that's your equation?
Yes, that's right, yes. Modulo boundary terms. Yeah. Question? Laurent, there is a...
So in BF, BV is indispensable when algebras do not close, right? Now, but in this case, could you just avoid BV and do BRS, for instance?
Well, no, because I want to deal with boundary. One can do everything with a hammer, I guess. But here it would be tricky because you want some sort of compatibility with the boundary data, and this is much clearer in this formalism, I would say.
Kasia, there is a question in the chat.
Yes.
By Igor. He's wondering whether the BV formalism for QED can be straightforwardly generalized to curve spacetimes.
Absolutely, yes, of course. Yes. So, and to Young-Mills theories and to effective gravity. So the BV story on curved spacetime, that would be my paper with Fred Hagen from 2013 that I haven't mentioned on the list because it doesn't have boundaries. But without boundaries, that's very well known, actually. It's known. but with boundary, it's actually more tricky. But there are great people working on it, so it's going to be great. Any other questions? Don't show. Okay, great. So that's the structure. Now, the equations of motion. So this is just a recap. We have the matter current, which is what you think it is. And the equations of motion are, well, the first one is d star f equals to the current. So it would be zero in the absence of matter. And then there are matter fields. Okay, and the current is conserved. All right. And here is an important bit, because we want non-trivial asymptotes of all that stuff. So we want J to fall off as 1 over t cubed, where t is the hyperbolic time. All right. So now here is the boundary action. So this is the correction you get from the double insertion of Q into the omega. So this is the compatibility condition. And yeah, so you can compute this actually. I mean, in a way, these things come from integrating by parts. And you get those boundary terms. And then this is just a nice box to put them into. And this is, well, you can see this is, there is a d here, right? So the whole thing naturally lives on the boundary of M. All right, and there is also the symplectic form, giving it just for completeness. I mean, again, you can compute what are the boundary fields, boundary components of all the players in that game. And, well, then you can check that this BFV operator Q, the induced VBFV operator Q partial is also a Hamiltonian vector field with respect to that boundary action, so that this holds. Again, I'm not going to prove that here, but well, I guess this can be found in the literature. So now, okay, so this is the whole setup. So the boundary action is going to make a return, but before that, I want to introduce some notation. So back to Scry again. Asymptotic variables. So I want to introduce some notation for the asymptotic fields. And here again, I'm going to use the notation of Herdegen, not just to confuse you on purpose, but I think it helps sometimes to look at things in a different perspective to find new stuff. Okay, so now, as I said, this variable r multiplies null direction. We go along null direction to infinity. So then we get the field, the asymptotic field on Scry. So for the vector potential, the asymptotic field will be v if we go into the future. And yeah, so L is then the direction on S2. So it's a null direction. And then we can also take the limit to the past along null direction. So these, because I want to be consistent with that work, he denotes it by V prime. Okay.
Sorry, question. So what the other thing called S is what everyone called U, right?
Yeah, is S the, is U. Okay, yeah, good. Yeah,
so
yeah.
That, so that, maybe, that's where maybe it could be nice.
Yeah. So S is U for people to think about, right? So S lives, so this is maybe something I should write. So S is plus infinity and S is minus infinity when I parameterize V of SL. So the future asymptote, and for the past asymptote, there is also similar parametrization, so then you have to play with the signs. It's terrible with the signs. So plus infinity for V prime is the same boundary as minus infinity for V. So this is then S is minus infinity. So these guys are...
And Kaja?
Yes?
Sorry. One more. Ooh. A is a one form.
Yes.
And here is it, and V is a one form too. In
correct.
Which direction? So does it contain also? the radial direction somehow, or is just the tangential piece?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, this, yeah, it contains the radial directions.
So it's
there are some consistency conditions on those.
It's a one form with four indices.
It's like in four indices, yes.
Is four, okay.
Yes. But they are not all independent. So I'm just suppressing indices because I'm as bad with indices as I'm with signs. So just not to provoke a disaster. Okay. So now if we don't have matter fields, then there is nothing interesting happening at I plus and I minus. So there is this condition that V of plus infinity is zero and V prime of minus infinity is zero. So no matter, nothing happens. But there is also the matching condition because these are asymptotes of the same field. So obviously V prime of plus infinity has to be equal to V of minus infinity. So that's the matching condition there. Now, this matching condition, okay, it's kind of has to be true by definition, but we will see a condition like that arriving from a completely different direction by studying the boundary action without any prejudice apart from the fact that things have to be solutions to equations of motion. So that condition is going to make a return. Okay, any questions to this setup? No, great. Okay, so now what's the deal with large gauge transformations? And you know, if I don't manage to say anything else, I think this is probably the most important bottom line from this story. So I wanted to understand what was the problem with large gauge transformations according to the paper of Hardegen. So let's see, now I'm trying to convey this to you and explain it to myself in the process. So we start with A with a Lorentz gauge. Lorentz gauge is nice. And then lambda is some gauge parameter. We consider a gauge transformation and we get lambda hat, okay? People do it all the time. So now everything has to have some reasonable asymptotic. So I want this transformation, delta L, to deliver non-trivial asymptotics at scry, okay? So that this transformation does something at infinity. Otherwise, it would be terribly boring. And then you can, well, do a little computation or again, look into the literature and you find out that the leading order is constant in S, depends only on L, and is zero order in R. And then, well, that kind of makes sense because then d lambda has to be of the same asymptotics as, you know, our vector potentials are, so it has to go 1 over r. And again, it multiplies something that doesn't depend on s. That's actually important in what follows. Also, I wanted to play nicely with my matter fields. So I want this lambda to actually satisfy Laplace equation at the hyperboloid at plus and minus infinity. So you can imagine this, you know, you have these matter fields that go into the future infinity. You have your photons leaving at null infinity, and there is that corner, there is that sphere S2 where they meet, and this is where I want to provide the boundary data for lambda. So this comes from the fact that in the end, you know, I have equation that relates, you know, the photon fields and matter, right? There is this box A equals J times constant. All right, so that I need. And hopefully I will be able to give you more details why. And also I need the matching condition at I0, right? Because we want to be able to talk about the same field asymptote. We don't want anything crazy to happen at I0. And here is the thing, and I think this is worth looking at, you know, in your spare time. he shows that if you want all of these, well, you're in trouble. You're in trouble, you have a problem, because you cannot meet all of these conditions at the same time. You cannot have a Lorentz gauge, this Laplace equation, and correct fall of asymptotics. So, okay, but that's not a tragedy. That's not a tragedy, this is just an observation. It means that a hat here for non-trivial large gauge transformation has to be in a different gauge than Lorentz. You can have something which looks like Lorentz gauge locally, but you cannot have globally Lorentz gauge. So, word of caution, I was kind of surprised by this fact, but here we are. All right. There was another thing that he points out, and this is of a more algebraic nature. So he says, well, these guys also, you know, on top of everything else, they don't preserve the symplectic structure on the boundary of M, so on scry. Now, if you come from asymptotic quantization community, then, well, people were trying to use that for gravity before. You know, there are these works of Ashtekar and so on. So asymptotic quantization was known to some extent, and you know how to write down the symplectic symplectic structure on at infinity. That was also kind of known. And then you can check, okay, that if you take one of those gauge transformations that satisfy everything apart from the Lorentz gauge, then you end up with something that obviously doesn't preserve this symplectic structure. So now you can ask yourself, is this a problem? Well, I would say it's not a problem. It's an advantage. It's a feature. Why? Because this is exactly what we are expecting from the BV-BFV perspective. This is not a coincidence, okay? So symplectic structure, here it is again. And now to apply large gauge transformation, so this ghost then has to be evaluated on a gauge parameter that has the right fall-off conditions and satisfies my wish list. Okay, and then you find out that, so if this was a symmetry of the symplectic structure, right, then this would be zero. Okay, this is not zero. This is actually exactly equal to the corner data. So it's equal to, the next level of my story. So one really needs the corner. If you want to do, asymptotic quantization of, QED, gravity, or whatever, you really need the corner. You really need to take into account, you know, all your codimensional data. So lesson learned. People do it in practice, but it's also good to know that there is a framework where it all fits together. So BV-BFV quantization does exactly the right extension of, the traditional formalism, which is compatible with large gauge transformations. Okay, so that was bottom line number one. Are there any questions at this point? Yes, Anthony. Doc.
Can you just remind me how you got the boundary symplectic structure?
So this is essentially the boundary fields, right? So yeah. You just look at what are the boundary fields for electromagnetism, and this is the natural. So these are the variables on the boundary, and this is the natural symplectic structure for those variables.
And then the next level symplectic structure is, again, you just do the variational principle and.
Yeah, essentially yes. Okay. And Michele, do you have any more words of wisdom? Catch. It's okay. Getting late, guys.
I, yeah.
The party's starting.
It's not broken, at least. So from the BV action, you do the usual variational principle. You get the presymplectic potential, and that gives you your symplectic form. Same thing starting from the boundary action to go to the corner. So you treat that as a Lagrangian. You treat the boundary action as an action. It's just that it's of a different degree, not degree zero.
We can discuss afterwards. And I do recommend my paper with Michele.
So, sorry, what's the relation between C in the corner symplectic structure and your lambda?
Ah, okay. So C is the ghost, right? So it's an evaluation functional on the gauge algebra. So then you can plug in a lambda. So C is something you can evaluate on a concrete gauge parameter. So in simple terms, I replace C by lambda in all the formulas. So that means evaluating at lambda. Does it make sense? Okay, great. Anything else? Okay, let me continue then. So this was goal number one, to resolve that controversy or, well, puzzle in the literature. And the other one was just a purely joyful exercise of deriving the conservation of asymptotic charges from the vanishing of the boundary action. So that's the rest of the talk. Now, if I don't get through all of this, this is also fine, but I just want to give you the gist. Okay, so here is the setup. Again, this is our finite region where we put our fields, and on this finite region, well, with boundary, we can write what the boundary action is. So that's that guy, and it has two bits, okay? So one is going to be with df, okay? So this is, now this is a spoiler, this is going to produce the soft charge, and the other is with the matter field, so obviously this produces the hard charge. So nothing too surprising in that. So now we want to compute that limit. That's all there is to be done. So yeah, soft charge, hard charge. Okay. Little interlude, because I haven't seen this spelled out here, so maybe makes sense to talk about it a bit. So we have the field equation, right? Box A equals 4 pi j. And now how do we solve that field equations like that, right? So this is something, you know, I teach my students, so you use a green function. And then you get, for example, you know, you take a particular solution to the inhomogeneous equation, and then you add to it a solution to the homogeneous equation. Okay, so for example, you take the retarded green function and get the retarded solution plus incoming gradation, which is the solution to the free equation, so without J. Or you do the other way around, so you get advanced green function and then outgoing gradation. So classical electromagnetism. Okay, but it's important that these in and out guys are solutions to essentially the free equation, so no J there. And then the difference between those guys is called the Pauli-Jordan function. Maybe that's not so important, but this is how you obtain the radiation field, is the difference between these two. Okay, so, you know, I have retarded advanced green functions, plug in the source, get retarded advanced solutions, right? And, well, here there is a bit of, let's say, extra computation to be done. So it turned out that you can compute this using the quantity which I'm going to denote here, Vj, which you obtain from your matter current by integrating it with this delta function. So you set y dot l, so y is, well, going over all spacetime. And you equate that to S by integrating with this delta. What is it? So essentially, it's the asymptotic field produced by is the asymptotic electromagnetic field produced by the matter current. Okay, so if I have the matter current, this is not going to vanish, and this lives here. So these guys are going to populate the corner. So they live in the corner. All right, so again, a bit more about asymptotic fields, and I want to say a few words about matching conditions and things like that. So as I said, so here are these, limits going to the upper corner and lower corner. And if I take J, which behaves like 1 over T tall cube, so then times some charge distribution, then I can write down the formula for J. Again, it's not so important what exactly these things are, but the point is that, okay, so this is expressible in terms of the charge distribution of my matter current. And then I can write some equations for these asymptotes. So this is the total field, asymptotic field living on scribe plus, and it has two pieces. So one coming from matter current and one coming from incoming radiation. Or I can do it a different way. I can write it in terms of this asymptotic value here, Vj at plus infinity in the corner plus outgoing radiation. So everything can be seen in these two pictures. And the same goes for V prime, which lives at scribe minus. So this is just counting these various fields. And in the corners, the only contributions in the corners, as I said, come from the fact that I have matter. So if I was to look at the contributions from these three guys from incoming and outgoing radiation, that would be zero. All right. I'm running out of time-ish, or? I'm not, okay, good. 15 minutes, okay. We'll leave you some time for questions. Okay, so this is the setup. These are the fields, and I'm keeping this picture there to refer to it. And now I want to compute the soft charge. Coming back to my formula, right, I'm trying to compute this limit, and then you see there's the integration scribe plus scribe minus, so I break it down into two pieces, the I plus and I minus piece, and calculation, and this is what I get. So let me just tell you what these pieces mean again. So this V out, show this one. So this V out of minus infinity, this comes from the fact that, okay, so I had integral over I plus. This piece here, this V epsilon plus, that comes from D lambda. So that comes from my gauge transformation. And maybe I should run back very quickly so that you can see something. Okay, so this is V lambda. That's the asymptotics of D lambda. And this doesn't depend on S. So it's constant along scry. So the only guy that depended on scry was the one coming from the second factor, okay? And this, well, because of that D here, this is going to contain a total derivative in variable S. So I will do the integration, you know, fundamental theorem of calculus, where I subtract the value of V out at plus infinity and at minus infinity. Now, I just said that this is the free radiation field. So it vanishes here. So the only contribution is from I zero. So that's this guy. And this is exactly the soft charge at scribe plus. And then the same computation goes per square minus, but you have to watch the signs. And again, you get a similar story by integration by parts. So now, if you want to see it in a more traditional notation, well, here it is. And in the paper, we do both for pedagogical reasons. So this is, again, the same calculation. And I want to make connection with the talk of Michele. So he was talking about this flux map. So the flux map is the map that takes lambda and assigns this guy. And well, as I understand, well, this is some analog of having an electric flux. So in this case, this is the electric flux through the corners. So if you remember that talk, then that's the connection. And if you don't, you should rewatch it and see the connection. OK, so that's the soft charge. Any questions? No questions? OK, leave the questions for later. Hard charge. Hard charge is harder. And well, it looks innocent. So we are computing this quantity again, evaluate at lambda, and we want to, well, take everything to future and past infinity, so on this nice hyperboloid. Okay, again, we have two pieces. There is the future piece of that hyperboloid and the past piece of that hyperboloid, and, well, lambda is what remains from, well, my gauge parameter, gauge function lambda, when you go to H plus, and rho plus was a charge distribution. So this is, so rho plus just comes from J. Okay, and now this is the other thing I said, so because there is this coupling between matter and the electromagnetic potential, well, this should solve Laplace's equation on H plus, we're on the boundary of that, so in that little corner, I want the boundary data to be given by the boundary data, well, that corresponds to the, let's see, I should probably go back again. It's better to, okay, right. So as I said, I had lambda in this sort of expansion, and I want this E plus to be a boundary data for lambda on the hyperboloid. So that's the same E plus. All right. So again, I know my Green functions. So I write lambda on the hyperboloid in terms of this boundary data and the Green function for Laplace's equation. And again, there are really cool formulae in Herdegen's work. So there is, for example, the formula for this Green function, which is not entirely obvious. Then I do some manipulation of these various asymptotic variables. And again, what pops out is the asymptotic field corresponding to my gauge transformation. So this is V epsilon plus. Okay, so in the end, I plug this all together. And then I realized that this piece was actually nothing else but the contribution from the current. And I arrive at the final formula for the hard charge. And it looks very similar to the formula for the soft charge. So this piece is the same. This is the piece coming from the gauge transformation. It has to be there. But instead of that piece coming from the free radiation field, this is the piece coming from the matter current contribution. OK, I do the same for scribe minus. And then I need to impose the matching condition for these epsilons so that, you know, my asymptotic field is continuous through I0. The total hard charge is obviously then given by the difference. The sign is because signs. And again, recalling some of these crazy formulae in terms of radiation and matter contribution, I arrive at the following. So here, the total charge is the sum of soft and hard, okay? And now if I add these two formulae together, so this was the hard one, and the soft one is here. I add them together. I use this, these two identities, and I find these relatively simple, okay, all things concerned, right, formulae for these charges, where, again, here you have the full asymptote, which is both radiation and matter contribution, and here you have the asymptotic field from d lambda. Okay, so now the bottom line, the last bottom line of this is going to be the following. So all of this was derived from this condition that the boundary action vanishes on shell. This squiggly line means on shell. So from that, we get the difference of these two charges is zero, so they are equal. But interestingly enough, if you look at these formulae, this implies, and is actually equivalent to the matching condition which I actually started with. So we have made a full circle. So this is, in a sense, a very, well, this is a natural consistency condition for that whole setup, which, again, is equivalent to charge conservation, which is equivalent to this condition for the boundary action. Okay, that was a wild ride. So I think that's it for now. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions? Here. Thank you very much.
So in the, yeah, thank you for this presentation. In the beginning, you mentioned quantization. So I want to go back to that. In my talk, I mentioned why I'm interested in this corner symmetry, because it gives a direct way to quantize. So
absolutely.
Can you tell me a little bit more, you know, how you're going to quantize?
Quantize,
like, how
are
you going to use, like, what is the wave functional? What's the, so what are the fundamental principle? And what are, you know, how can you access some kind of non-perturbative?
Yeah, okay, so let me go back to these works, actually, because, I mean, Herdegen's aim was also quantization. So he provides quantization of the asymptotic structure, so just the boundary thing, in terms of operator algebras. So he assigns, like, observables to regions. So now this has to be enhanced with the corner data. So this is... well, we require some combination of that together with BV-BFV formalism. So I would say do BV-BFV formalism in a sort of AQFT-ish framework. So this is what we are doing with Michele right now. So yeah, that's
so
how I would imagine.
BV-BFV gives you, let's say, you have new types of states and what kind of non-perturbative information does that?
Well, non-perturbative
or does it
or
give
perturbative,
you a better,
it essentially gives you, well, the rule for finding observables, because observables have to, satisfy some conditions with respect to this BV operator. So one thing it gives you, it gives you the tool to resolve your equations of motion and symmetries, and then deformation quantize, I would say. So it's a machinery that allows you to construct these algebras systematically and then identify observables. So and then with the states, there are some natural states that come with it. So that's more PAQFT framework. And in the end, you know, I hope that we can make contact with that as well. That would be cool. And then obviously try to follow the program you outlined and see if these things work together.
All right, Kasia, you have a question in the chat. And then if we can, Selinka, can you please give the cube to Susheta? For the very last one, so the question in the chat is, large gauge transformation a la Strominger are not symplethomorphism in the symplectic BVF analysis, then in what sense do they correspond to symmetries of the theory?
Well, exactly in the sense I said. So, yeah, because what you want, right, so what you want in this situation with corners, right? So if we didn't have corners, then obviously that would be a disappointment. But if we are considering the situation with corners, then the natural thing to expect is actually this sort of compatibility condition with the corner data. So. I don't know. Maybe is there some interpretation in terms of your fluxes, guys? Is there something? Yeah. Yes. Maybe. Yeah. Cube?
Yeah,
cube?
There is a cube arriving cube. In right now.
I think we will see very similar formulas tomorrow in my talk.
Mm-hmm.
And what
come
happens
to Aldo's talk.
So I don't fully understand the entire connection between the two, but the two formulas. But in what I will present tomorrow, these corner data appear naturally after the first stage reduction. So, and they are part of the symplectic space associated to just cry.
Mm-hmm.
Did you add something?
There is just a residual symmetry that acts on this corner data, and that also has to be taken care of. Yeah, maybe you don't call it residual, but there is some gauge symmetry on corners that needs to be taken care of. So in that sense, it is symmetry, it is gauge symmetry, but not in the strict sense.
Not in the naive sense.
Not
yeah,
in the strict sense.
It's a weaker notion of what it means to be a symmetry, but I claim that this is the right notion for this context. So, right. Because we have the corner data as well, which is giving us non-trivial structure.
All right. Okay. We take Susheta's question.
I have a two-part question. So, can you play the same game for the non-abelian case, Yang-Mills?
Sure. Yes.
Yes. So then, part
in
B
principle,
is: do you know the answer? I mean, are there asymptotic symmetries which can be defined?
Well, I mean, I guess that would require some calculation. But yeah, I mean, I expect, because this actually nicely reproduced, I mean, both Herdegen's and Strominger's work in terms of actual formulae in the end. So, and there are calculations for non-abelian symmetry. So I don't expect that this is going to deliver something outlandishly different. But we haven't done the calculation, so.
Yeah, because the reason I ask is because, of course, we have some results at Scry Plus.
Yeah.
I mean, null infinity.
Yeah.
But at spatial, there is, again, some discrepancy with spatial infinity.
Ah, then maybe we should look at it. Okay, maybe we should look at it.
For QED, it's resolved because you can add some corner terms like we did here. But for Yang,
for sure. Okay, then we look at it. Thank you.
Okay, that's not yet.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right, I propose we thank you, Kasia, again.
Thank you.